that hideous strength.
Just as James Studdock had foreseen in a dream, Merlin has risen from his tomb in Bragdon Wood. But will he side with good or evil? The race is on to secure his services, and Jane, Arthur and Dr. Dimble set out to hunt him down. But the NICE appear to have found him first. A bearded, naked man, he now lies in a bed at their headquarters at Belbury. But surprisingly, he doesn't understand Latin, and the NICE must advertise for an expert in other ancient languages. Meanwhile, at St. Anne's, Mr. Fisher King and the circle of friends who are all that remain of the legendary kingdom of Logra are waiting for Jane and her companions to return. When out of the wind and rain, they hear a horse approaching, and a fist beats at the door.
Famule, dic domino huius domus. Hello, tell the lord of this house that I am come.
How are you, doctor?
When I've got my breath, I'll be fine.
Oh, what a night.
Where is everybody? Didn't they wait up for us? Look, there's McLean, behind the chair.
Extraordinary place to fall asleep.
Is he asleep?
McLean? McLean? Are you all right, McLean?
All right. I am all right. There's been a man here.
What sort of a man?
Oh, well, that's not easy to... I fell asleep as he was talking, to tell you the truth.
What do you mean?
I just can't bring to mind what he was saying.
Lord save us! And the director with him?
What?
I know. Now what happened? He hypnotized me. There was a horse, too. I remember the horse.
The horse!
Come on. If he's here, we'll find him. Mrs. Dimble and Camilla are all fast asleep.
We spotted you too.
They're all right. They must be the same as he did to me. With no time to wake them. Go on.
Nothing here. Nor here. Try upstairs.
There are lights on.
Excuse me. I think perhaps I'd better go first.
Up to the first landing, they're in darkness. On the second and the last, the light falls from above. Jane, who is last, sees McPhee and Dr. Dimble stop dead on the second landing. Forcing her tired limbs to run, Jane gets beside them and sees what they do. Looking down on them from the balustrade are two men. One, Mr. Fisher King, the director, standing straight and still without his stick. The other, a huge monster of a man. And this stranger is speaking in Latin and pointing at her.
Vir optime. Indomo tua feminam falsissimam omnium qui nunc vivo.
You have in your house the falsest lady of any at this time alive.
Vir optime fares. Ecatrix sine dubes.
Sir, you are mistaken. She is doubtless, like all of us, a sinner. But the woman is chaste.
Sir, know well that it was the purpose of God that she and her lordship between them have begotten a child by whom the enemies would have been put out of Logra for 1,000 years. For 100 generations, in 2 lines, the begetting of this child was prepared, and unless God should rip up the work of time, such seed shall never be again.
She is but lately married. The child may yet be born.
Be assured that the child will never be born. For the hour of its begetting is past.
It is as well that Jane cannot understand Latin. More than that they speak of her, she cannot tell. Dimble, however, understands all, and is therefore appalled to hear...
It would be great charity if you gave order that her head should be cut from her shoulders, for it is a weariness to look at her.
Director, what in heaven's name is the meaning of this? What are you doing with that bloodthirsty old man?
This man is Merlinus Ambrosius. Merlin. The NICE at Belbury thought that if he came back, he would be on their side. I find he is on ours.
Do I understand, Mr. Director, that you're asking us to accept this person as a member of our organization?
He is a member of the organization.
I must ask what inquiries have been made into his credentials.
It would be hard to explain to you my reasons for trusting Merlinus Ambrosius. But no harder than to explain to him why I trust you. Now, come. You have none of you slept tonight. Apart from you, of course, McPhee.
I did so.
Jane, before you retire, would you bring up a bottle of burgundy?
Yes.
And light the fire in the blue room.
And sleep comes to all. In the morning, after he has bathed...
Oh, Liam!
Merlin calls loudly for oil. Denniston's exertions while shopping in the village finally produce a tin of brilliantine, which Merlin uses so freely that his hair and beard glisten, and a sweet, sticky smell fills the blue room. That is why Mr. Bultitude, the bear, paws so insistently at the door that he is finally admitted, and now sits as near the magician as he can possibly get, his nostrils twitching. He has never smelt such an interesting man before.
Sir, I give you great thanks.
You are welcome.
I cannot understand the way you live. And your house is strange to me. You give me a bath such as the emperor himself might envy. Mm-hmm. But no one attends me to it. A bed softer than sleep itself. And when I rise from it, I find I must put on my own clothes as if I were a peasant. You eat dry and tasteless flesh. But it is off plates as smooth as ivory and as round as the sun. Does your wound pain you?
No, it is not the wound. We have terrible things to talk of.
Sir, I could take all the anguish from your heel as though I were wiping it out with a sponge. Give me but 7 days to renew old acquaintance. These fields and I, this wood and I, have much to say to one another.
You might find the country much changed.
No, I do not reckon to find it much changed. Not changed. Through me, you can suck up from the earth oblivion of all pains.
No. No, you were not dug up from the earth to give me a plaster for my wound. We have drugs that could cheat the pain as well as your earth magic, or better, if it were not my business to bear it to the end.
I hear and obey, but I meant no harm. If not to heal your wound, yet for the healing of Logre. You will need my commerce with field and water. It will not be changed, you know. Not what you would call changed.
And Merlin seems like something that ought not to be indoors. Bathed and anointed though he is, a sense of mold, gravel, wet leaves, weedy water hangs about him.
Not changed.
But the soul has gone out of the wood and the water. Oh, I dare say you could awake them a little. But it would not be enough. A storm or even a river flood would be of little avail against our present enemy. For the hideous strength confronts us. And it is as in the days when Nimrod built a tower to reach heaven.
I will set a sword in every blade of grass to wound them, and the very clods of earth shall be venom to their feet.
I forbid you to speak of it. Whatever of spirit may still linger in the earth has withdrawn 1,500 years further away from us since your time. You shall not lift your little finger to call it.
I command you.
It is in this age utterly unlawful. It never was very lawful, even in your day.
Sir, if I am not to work for you in that fashion, then you have taken into your house a silly bulk of flesh. For I am no longer much of a man of war. Perhaps, though, it was rumored in my day that among the heathen there were some that were not wholly corrupt, men who knew not the articles of our most holy faith, but who worshipped God as they could and acknowledged the law of nature. Mm. I know not where. Babylon, Arabia, or Cathay. I believe it would be lawful to seek help even there.
You do not understand, Malin. The poison was brewed in these west lands. But it has spat itself everywhere by now. No power that is merely earthly will serve against the hideous strength.
Then let us all to prayers.
Now and always. But that was not what I meant. There are celestial powers. Created powers, not in this earth, but in the heavens.
Oh, yeah.
Those powers of heaven have come down to this house.
Yeah.
And in this chamber where we are now, Malakandra and Perelandra, which we call Mars and Venus, have spoken to me.
What will come of this? If they put forth their power, they will unmake all Middle Earth.
Their naked power, yes. That is why they will work only through a man.
Huh?
A man whose mind is opened to be so invaded. One who has dabbled in magic in the days when dabbling had not begun to be evil. A Christian man and a penitent. In all these western parts, there was only one man who had lived in those days and could still be recalled. You.
Silence. Sit down. You put us both to shame.
Sir, you are the Pendragon.
Yes.
You have been in heaven. You are not as I. You have looked on their faces before.
Greater spirits than I have looked on will descend this time. There is no promise that either you or I will save our lives or our reason. I do not know how we can dare to look upon their faces. But I do know we cannot dare to look upon God's if we refuse this enterprise.
Since day and night make no difference in Mark's cell, he doesn't know whether it is minutes or hours later that the cell door opens and Augustus Frost returns to lead him once more into the presence of that gaping and dribbling monstrosity, the head of Alcazan. But to Mark's surprise, Frost takes not the slightest notice of it. He leads him across to a narrow door in the far wall.
Go in. You will speak to no one of what you find here. I will return presently.
It is an empty committee room. A cold, grey place with unhappy proportions.
Ugly place.
He notices the door. He wonders if he is the victim of an optical illusion.
No. The point of the arch isn't in the centre. The whole thing's lopsided.
He notices spots on the ceiling.
But they're not dirt or discoloration. They're deliberately painted on.
Not a great many of them.
30?
Or is it 100?
I'm not counting them. I'm not falling into that trap.
They'd be hard to count. They're so irregularly placed.
Or are they? Perhaps it's some sort of pattern up there. Yes. There's five in that little group to the right. Almost regular. Come on, stop it. This is what they want you to do.
The pictures round the walls belong to a school of art with which he is already familiar.
A young girl, her mouth open.
And the inside of her mouth thickly overgrown with hair.
A giant mantis playing fiddle.
While being eaten by another mantis.
A man with corkscrews instead of arms. Bathing in a sadly coloured sea.
And then the pictures with scriptural themes.
But in every one, something is odd, out of place.
Who is that person standing between the Christ and Lazarus?
Why are there so many beetles under the table in the Last Supper?
The very ordinariness of the pictures becomes their supreme menace. Like the ominous surface innocence at the beginning of some dreams.
I suppose this room is the first step towards achieving what they'll call my objectivity.
Ah, yes, objectivity. The process whereby all specifically human reactions are killed in a man so that he might become fit for the fastidious society of the macrobes.
And there'll be worse things, that's for sure. God knows what. Eating abominable food. Dabbling in dirt and blood. Performing calculated obscenities.
But after an hour or so, this long, high coffin of a room begins to produce on Mark an effect which his instructor has probably not anticipated. The built and painted perversity has the effect of making him aware, as he has never been aware before, of this room's opposite. As the desert teaches men to love water, or as absence reveals affection, there rises up against this background of the sour and the crooked some kind of vision of the sweet and the straight. He's not thinking in moral terms at all. He is thinking of something he vaguely calls the normal. And it's all mixed up with
Jane.
And fried eggs.
And soap.
And sunlight.
Come with me. You must remain here on duty until you are relieved.
On duty?
If the patient on the bed speaks or stirs, you are to ring the deputy director immediately. You are to say nothing. Indeed, it would be useless if you did, because the patient does not understand English. Remember, ring up immediately if he stirs.
Patient? Looks like a damn tramp. Ah, thank God for a fire anyway.
Yeah. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to... I beg your pardon.
Foreigners, eh?
You do speak English, then?
Yeah. Good, man. You haven't got such a thing as a bit of backy about you, eh?
At St. Anne's, an unusual thing has happened to Mr. Bultitude, for he's got out into the garden without being muzzled, and the bear has passed a very agreeable morning investigating the turnips. Now, in the early afternoon, he has approached the garden wall. I think there is a sense in his mind of endless green lands beyond it, and bees the size of sparrows, and innumerable hives. There is a chestnut tree near the wall, which the bear can easily climb. And from its branches, he can drop down on the far side.
No, I put up. See, look at that.
A bloody great bear. Here, it's not ours, is it?
Of course not. You were in her cage this morning. Here,
let's give it.
Why? Well, bears cost money. I don't know, the NIC wants another one, and here it is, free.
Oh, all right, then. Hop out and ask it to step inside.
But your favour, now we'll dope it.
Not with mine, then she won't.
Oh, well, we'll have to use mine, then. Where's the bottle?
Here.
Right. Here you are, then. Hey, good boy. Ooh, come on, Bruin. Here's a good boy. Hey. Dinner time.
You know, I think it's best if you go on pretending you don't understand English.
Yeah, foreigners, eh?
Yes. Actually, they're not foreigners, you know, but they are very dangerous people, and I think your best plan is to keep silent. Yes.
Don't get no doubt to me, eh? Ah, Dolly, you and me knows that.
But as regards the future...
Oh, Hey.
Yes, of course. You see, we're both in considerable danger.
Ah, foreigners, eh?
No, no, I told you they weren't. They seem to think you are, though.
They got no doubt on me.
I've been trying to think out some sort of plan.
Ah.
And I was wondering...
Ah, Dally.
What?
I've got a plan.
What is it? Go on, what is it?
Had it be... If you and I made ourselves a nice bit of toasted cheese.
Who are you?
Jane, what is it?
A huge woman. Same colored dress. Her breasts exposed. Her eyes mocking me. Her skin's dark. Honey colored. Red cheeks. red limbs. Black eyes. Brutal. Ogreish. Gleeful.
Jane.
Coming to watch
Jane,
me.
Can you hear me?
Who is she?
Can you speak to her, dear?
She holds a torch. Save me. Oh, be careful. Look out. Oh, you burn the room. You burn the house. Get back. Your father's bone.
Jane, you're awake now.
Yes. That was so frightening.
Yes, yes.
I saw this woman.
Yes, I know you were telling me.
Was she real?
Oh, yes. Yes, she is real enough.
Who was she?
Did you know that in each planet there is a representative of every other planet? She, Jane, is our terrestrial Paralandra, otherwise known as Venus.
I don't understand.
No, I don't suppose you would. But you were perhaps bound to meet her. She is what you'll get if you won't have the other.
How do you mean, sir?
It's to do with what I spoke of before. Obedience within marriage. Obedience to your marriage. You have rejected your husband, you know. You have rejected the masculine in him. Just as he, I have no doubt, has abused the feminine in you. Now, if yours was a virginal rejection of the male, God would allow it. And you would go on to meet something far more masculine than a man later on. But you are not a virgin. Neither are you a Christian. If you were a Christian wife, your meetings with Venus would be tempered. As you are not, you get her raw, dangerous, demoniac. And you don't like it.
You mean I'm repressing something?
Yes, yes. And I'm afraid there's no escape for you. Oh. There is no place in this world for someone who won't be either a pagan or a Christian. You have recoiled from the invasion of your body in marriage through what the old poets called danger. We call it pride. You are offended by the masculine itself, a loud, eruptive, possessive thing against which you resort to primness. But at some stage you will have to surrender. The male you could escape, for that exists only on the biological level. But the masculine, none of us can escape. What is above and beyond all things is so masculine that we are all feminine in relation to it.
You mean I shall have to become a Christian?
Looks like it. If for no other reason than to temper the effects of Venus. And by the way, she is going to be especially active here tonight. Oh. I want you to tell the others you must all stay together tonight. In the kitchen, perhaps. Do not come upstairs.
Why, sir?
Our enemies at Belbury have advertised for an interpreter. An expert in archaic dialects. We shall send them one. Oh, yes, by the splendor of Christ, we will send them one. Tonight, I will bring Merlin before my masters. He will be opened. Powers will pass into him. But why is Wither talking to him in Latin?
Eu videtur omnes linguas nostra singulare, atque a nobis cura est, atque...
Wish I knew Latin.
...laboramus ut comperiamus quisit in veritate.
Seems to be something about the old trap.
Interroga civis, sed non Latine, non interrogit.
Non, Domine, lingua antiqua.
What a huge man that priest is. Hello?
The old tramp's seen him and is pretending to stay asleep. His eyes definitely came open. He won't get away with that performance.
What have you asked the priest to do?
He's trying a number of ancient languages to find which one the young old man understands.
But where did you find him?
He was sent in answer to our advertisement.
Doesn't he speak English?
No, no, he's a Basque priest.
A Basque?
But look, look, the old man's shivering. Hmm? Jackie, he said, I think he's trying to say something. Hmm?
He is. He's whispering back.
What in heaven's name is going on? The priest looks scared.
What's he saying? Quick, tell the priest to translate.
Domine Latine civis.
Me dicit. Me dicit. Oh, impossible est. Senex me dicit se esse Merlinum Ambrosium. Somno quindicim seculorum sub terra regresso.
What's he doing with that? What did he say?
He said the old man told him that he's who we thought he was, returned from a sleep of 15 centuries beneath the ground.
Oh, my God. This is pure lunacy. They're kneeling. They're kneeling to the tramp. I don't believe it. They're kissing his hand.
Mr. Wither, I wonder if you would spare a moment outside.
Certainly.
Starak, you stay here with the priest and the patient.
Oh, blimey. They couldn't have believed it. It's a knockout. A fair knockout.
There's something extraordinary about that priest. He's absolutely huge. And his eyes are remarkable. I wish he wouldn't look at me like that.
What is it? What's the matter?
It looked, I say looked, as if the man in the bed were only doing what the Basque priest instructed.
Oh, surely. How would a Basque priest come to invent the story that our guest was Merlinus Ambrosius?
That is the point. If the man in the bed is not Merlin, then someone else, namely the priest, knows our whole plan of campaign.
We must consult the head as soon as possible. This evening?
No, we can't. Have you forgotten? It's the inaugural banquet.
Wait. Our dear director, Jules, is coming. He'll be dancing attendance on him till midnight.
You have therefore considered at once what to do with the priest and, the old man.
We must get back to them. We have left them alone far too long.
Without a plan,
we must be guided by circumstance.
I cannot stay here. This Merlinus is a diabolist, a worker of infernal miracles. Look what he did to the poor young man the moment you had left the room. He sent him to sleep merely by looking at him. The evil eye.
And listen. If you do what you are told, no harm will come to you. If you do not, you will be destroyed. Ask Merlinus what we should do now. Get on.
He says he must bathe and be dressed, then he must be taken through your house and shown the secrets.
Tell him that it will be a very great pleasure and privilege.
He says that he will go with one of you alone. With you, sir.
Me?
He says it is an old habit of his to be obeyed. He is asking you now whether you wish to have him for a friend or an enemy.
Pray, ask him to step this way, and you come with us.
What's happening?
Merlinus wishes me to show him the house and its secrets alone.
I will allow no such arrangement.
My dear Frost, this is hardly the moment, and one of us must be free to meet Jules. You had better rouse Stadak if you can.
Stadak! Stadak! Get up! What do you mean by sleeping here? Come with me to the objective room.
Now, in the objective room, there lies, stretched out on the floor beneath the spotted ceiling, a work of art in the Spanish tradition. A large crucifix, ghastly and realistic.
We have half an hour to pursue our exercises. You must trample on this. Stamp on the face. Spit on it. Abuse it in any way you can.
But look, I...
What is it? Be quick. We have very little time.
This is all just superstition, isn't it?
Well, all if so,
What is their objective about stamping on the face? Isn't it just as subjective to spit on a thing like this as to worship it? I mean, if it's only a bit of wood, why do anything about it? That is superficial. If you'd been brought up in a non-Christian society, you would not be asked to do this. Of course it is superstition. But it is that particular superstition which has pressed upon our society for a great many centuries.
Yes.
It still forms a dominant system in the subconscious of many individuals who appear to be wholly liberated. Now, pray, make haste.
The quiet urgency of Frost's voice almost conquers Mark. He is on the verge of obeying and getting the whole silly business over. When the defenselessness of the figure deters him. The feeling is an illogical one. His reluctance is not because its hands are nailed and helpless, but because
they're made of wood and helpless.
Because the thing, for all its realism, is inanimate
and cannot in any way hit back.
He remembers one of his sister's dolls, which he once pulled to pieces as a child.
What are you waiting for, Mr. Stoddock?
Mark is aware of the rising danger.
If I disobey, my last chance of leaving Belbury alive may be gone. I'm as helpless as this wooden Christ.
Christianity is nonsense, but he does not doubt that the man once lived and was executed thus by the Belbury of his day.
Yes, and this is what will happen to me if I remain on the side of the straight. This is what the crooked does to the straight. Do you intend to go on with the training or not? But Christianity is a fable, and it would be ridiculous to die for a fable. This man himself on this very cross discovered it to be a fable and died complaining of it.
But then, is this the moment to turn against the man? If the universe is a cheat, is that a good reason for joining its side?
Mr. Stoddock, I am waiting for you to start. It's all bloody nonsense, and I'm damned if I'll do any such thing.
Ah, Mr. Frost, I am sorry to interrupt. But I believe that our esteemed director, Mr. Jules, is waiting for us in the drawing room. Ladies and gentlemen, it is with great pleasure, nothing could give me greater pleasure, in fact.
You ridiculous thing, with the jewels and the idiotic old train between them. They seem to think he's someone special. If only they knew. Better not look at him, he winked at me then.
I am sure there is not one of you who needs an introduction. The esteemed director of the NICE, Mr. Horace Jules.
James.
Thank you, Mr. Wibber. I'm reminded of a story I once heard in a cocktail lounge.
Jane, can you hear me?
Yes, yes.
What can you see?
It's a huge banqueting room. Someone's making a speech. And there's a sort of tramp-looking man at the top table.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and there's Marlin standing behind him.
Is Mark there?
Mark? Oh, yes, there he is. Next to the very fat Italian man who was there when they saw Alcazan's age.
Just after.
I mean, speaker. Yes, he seems to be the cockney.
Ah, Horace Jules.
But who may be recognised by you. And that is as gross an anachronism as to trust to Calvary for salvation in modern war.
Oh, that's wrong, surely.
What?
Jules has just said Calvary, but he must have meant cavalry.
With the delicate balances of human potential, and we must accept the challenge of the past by throwing down the gauntlet of the future.
Oh, come on, you can't get away with a line like that.
We meet that challenge with determination, and meet it we must, because the future density of mankind suspends upon the implosion of the horses of nature.
What on, must be drunk.
And the madrigal of verjuice must be Talsibianized.
What is it, Jane?
Richard Jules is talking nonsense.
Can you see Merlin?
Yes. He's got his eyes fixed on Jules.
Ah.
He seems to be concentrating very hard.
And are people listening to Jules?
Well, everyone looks puzzled.
Ah.
Mark's laughing. He's got his head down so that no one will see.
And evenly deranging. The surrogates implanted in a continual of porous variations. We shall not. till we can secure the elevation of all Prestungerian
items. Yes, they're all laughing. And now Mr. Withers standing. He's forcing Mr. Jill to sit down.
Hey, such a blow.
I think Mr. Withers is going to restore order.
Tidies and Fugleman, I feel for that we all have most deeply debacle and defensible, though I trust laboratory
absolute chaos. There's fight spreading out everywhere.
Where's Mary?
I can't see him or the chap. Oh, there's Miss Hardcastle.
Yes.
She's locking the doors. She's locking everyone in. And there's Lord Feverton. She's climbing up through a starving hatch. Now with her and Jules are fighting. Oh, no! Miss Hardcastle's got a gun! Shoot her! It's Jules! Oh, no! No!
What is it, Jane?
There's something under the tables. Everyone's terrified.
What is it?
I don't know. There it is. Oh, it's gone again. Oh, there. Black and torn his dress. Tiger! They've all panicked. They're trying to get out of the door. But it's locked. Oh, they trampled. The tiger, it's got Miss Hardcastle. Oh, they're terrible. And now there's a wolf. And a snake. Where are they coming from?
The vivisection.
What?
I think Merlin has released the vivisection.
And a gorilla. Oh, they're killing everyone. They're not keeping them. They're just killing them and going on to the next. And an elephant. Lifting someone in his trunk.
Three men know a way out of that room, and three men know the secret inner sanctum, where with its tubes and dials, its regulated blood and induced breathing, the ghastly head of Alcazan hangs on its bracket. Picture them now. Wither, Strake, and Philostrato, all of them daubed with blood. Philostrato, with his right arm badly mauled, walking down the passages towards it. Philostrato is not an initiate. He knows nothing of the macrobes. He believes that his skill and his skill alone has really kept that brain alive. Wither takes his left arm firmly, Strake his other. Drake and Wither lead him, with no antiseptic preparations, straight into the presence of the head. He wants to protest. Such carelessness could undo all his work. But his attempt is absurd, for language is now denied him. He watches as his two guys take off their clothes. They pluck his off, too. And the right sleeve, stiff with his blood, does not move. Wither rips it with a knife. And they stand naked before the head. Gaunt, big-boned Strake, Wither, an obscene senility. Philostrato, a wobbling mountain of fat. Then the high ridge of terror from which Philostrato is never again to descend is reached. For what he thinks impossible begins to happen. No one reads dials nor adjusts the pressure, yet the dead man's mouth moves. They drop to their knees.
Another. Give me another head.
Philostrato knows at once why they are forcing him to a certain place in the room. He devised it himself. But this little guillotine is not meant to be used like this. It should all be prepared weeks beforehand. The temperature of the room exactly right. The blade sterilized. The attachment all ready to be made almost before the head is severed. He has even calculated what change the terror of the victim will make to the blood pressure. The supply should be arranged accordingly. His last thought is that he has underestimated the terror.
Aurobarindra, Baba Ji.
But almost before the fat, dead legs and buttocks of the Italian cease quivering, the same thought strikes Strake and Wither. That the head will ask for
another.
And Wither has the knife.
No!
A straight bolt. No. Wither is after him, both of them slipping in Philostrato's blood. Wither slashes repeatedly with his knife. He has not strength to cut through the neck. But he has killed him. Wither stands. But there is something there. Something is moving. Could it be that they did not shut the outer door? And Mr. Bultitude's dark mind is filled with excitement as he remembers forbidden, forgotten pleasures. Warm, salt tastes, the pleasant resistances of bone, things to crunch and lick and worry.
Yes, I can see it all. They're all dead. The floor of the dining hall is completely covered. The electric light's on and it's quiet. Oh, wait. Somebody's coming. Oh, it's Merlin. He's picking his way through the bodies. He seems to be looking. He's bending down. He's found someone. Oh, it's Mark. He's alive. He's alive.
Thank you.
He seems to be in a daze.
Sergei, Miss Ellen.
What?
Sergei, Miss Ellen.
He's shouting something at him, but Mark won't understand Latin.
What is he saying?
Sergei, Miss Ellen.
Ah, get up, wretched boy.
Oh, well, yes, Mark seems to have got the message. And now Merlin's giving him a note.
Ah, yes, that'll be Denniston's note.
Oh. Your wife awaits you at the Manor of St. Anne's. Come quickly by road as best you can. Do not go near Edge.
Now Merlin's pushing him. Hmm? He's leading him over the bodies, down the passage, and out of the door. Oh, it's snowing. It's bitterly cold. Merlin stumped him in the back. He seems to be running for his life.
And as Mark runs, so Augustus Frost, in his own way, attempts to flee. He goes into the objective room, pours petrol on the floor and furniture, and strikes a match. And this is the first moment at which he begins to suspect that death itself might not cure the illusion of having a soul. The death might indeed prove the entry into a world where that illusion rages unchecked. He begins to know, but simultaneously refuses to know, that souls exist. He half sees the holy hearts. The physical torture of the burning is hardly fearsome in his hatred. In this attitude, eternity overtakes him, as sunrise the old tales overtakes time and turns them into unchangeable stone.
Sir, now I can see Lord Feverston. He's escaped too. He's outside Bellbury, amongst a lot of cars.
Where the hell's my... Anything is that Bentley? It's been stolen, damn it. Damn it!
Huh? Well, at least I can speak again. Another consolation. There's enough left for me to steal half a dozen. They're not going to need them. How about this one?
Good. Who's that?
Imagination playing tricks. Anyway, let's try this for size. Now then, should be simple enough.
What? Who's that?
It's only a soul.
It's only a bat, for God's sake! Please, we'll never move alone. Oh, if there is someone in control of this, please, for God's sake, slow down. We're going to fall!
Louis Birmingham, right?
Roughly. At least I'm going to St. Anne's.
Oh, well, I can take you to the turnoff. That'll save you a bit.
Thanks.
Oh, please.
Oh,
As Feverstone extricates himself from the upturned car, he sees that he's not alone. A tall and massive figure in a black cassock is before him, its back towards him, walking steadily away. The figure turns, looks at him in silence, then resumes its walk.
All right. Go on, then. I don't like the look of you in any case. In fact, I seldom like the look of anyone less.
The black figure comes to a gate. Next moment.
How the hell did that happen?
The man is over the gate and on the horse's back and off at a canter across the field that rises milk-white with snow to the skyline.
Well, good riddance. Where does that leave me? Where the hell am I?
When all this is finished, Mrs. Dimble, what will the director do?
He has longed to go back to Perelandra, Jane, to Venus. It's a sort of homesickness. One can see it in his eyes.
Oh. I wonder if he will ever see Merlin again.
Oh, I don't think so. I don't think either he or the director expected him to come back.
No.
When I saw him in my vision with all those dreadful things happening all around him, you could see in his face that he was a man used up to the last. What on earth's that?
If the war was still on, I'd have said it was a bomb.
Come and look. Look.
What?
Look, all right, it is a register. It's bright as day.
And so hot.
It has begun.
Oh, stop. Will you come on? Stop down now. Damn you. Oh, come on. You stop. Come on, pull over. There's a good chap. You're going to rest now.
Fuck hell. But you fetch those back there. If that's what you fancy.
All right, then. Go to hell.
In the end, there is nothing for it but to walk. Every vehicle is going away from Edgestone, none going towards it.
It's getting infernally hot.
All around him, snow is melting in the fast increasing heat. Haze from the melting snow fills the air. When he reaches the brow of the last descent into Edgestone, he can see nothing of the city, only fog, through which extraordinary coruscations of light come up to him. He's a few paces down the hill when he decides to turn.
I'll follow the exodus. I'll make for London.
He turns. But instead of going up, he finds he is still descending, as if he were on shale. The ground slips beneath him, and he slides 30 yards down the hill. He tries again. He's flung off his feet. He rolls downwards, stones, earth, grass, and water pouring onto him. A wave of earth. Behind him, the valley has been turned into hell. The pit of fog burns with a blinding violet flame. Water roars, buildings crash. His mouth and hair and nose are full of earth. The slope grows steeper. The ridge heaves up, and the whole wave of earth rises, arches, trembles, and with all its weight and noise, falls down on him.
Are you tired, sir? Is the pain bad?
No, Grace, it isn't that. But now that it's so nearly time for me to go, all this begins to feel like a dream.
I suppose you have to go, sir.
Ah, my dear. What else is there to do? I shall be sorry to leave Locra, but I have not grown a day older since I came back from Perelandra. And there is no natural death to look forward to. My wound will only be healed in the world where it was got.
That is clean contrary to the observed laws of nature.
It is not contrary to the laws of nature. Your mistake is to think that the laws you've observed on this planet are universal laws, and there are always exceptions in any system.
Not many exceptions to the law of death have come my way.
If you two don't stop arguing, I think I shall make you marry one another.
Can you tell me, sir, what you mean by Logra?
Ah, Logra. You tell her, Dr. Dimble.
Well, it's a sort of haunting. How something we may call Britain is always haunted by something we may call Logra.
Haven't you noticed how we are two countries? After every Arthur, a Mordred. Behind every Milton, a Cromwell, a nation of poets, a nation of shopkeepers. Is it any wonder they call us hypocrites? But what they mistake for hypocrisy is really the struggle between Logra and Britain. Some time ago, when our director returned from Venus, he was summoned to the bedside of an old man then dying in Cumberland. That man was the Pendragon, the successor of Arthur and Uther and Casa Bellorn. Our director received from him the office and the blessing. Some of the Pendragons are well known to history, though not under that name. Others you have never heard of. But in every age, they and the little Logra which gathered round them have been the fingers which gave the tiny shove, or the almost imperceptible pull, to prod England out of the drunken sleep, or to draw her back from the final outrage into which Britain tempted her.
This history of yours is a wee bit lacking in documents.
It has plenty. But you do not know the language they are written in. When the history of these last few months comes to be written, there'll be no mention in it of you and me, nor of Merlin and the Pendragon and the planets. And yet, in these months, Britain rebelled most dangerously against Logra and was defeated just in time. Ah. Open the door, Mr. Denniston.
Mr. Bultitude! And half covered in snow! Oh, look here!
Oh, there's another bear! Oh.
Is there indeed? Then I strongly suspect, Arthur, that that is the future Mrs. Bultitude.
Look how bright it is outside. It's as if a whole dome of light is standing over the garden.
Open all the windows. The vessel in which I must ride is now almost within the air of this world.
As Mark draws near St. Anne's, his mind is not at ease. He knows he is going to meet Jane. Moments of unforgettable failure in their short married life rise in his mind. In the past, he has thought of what he called Jane's moods. Now he thinks of his own clumsy importunity. Inch by inch, all the lout
and clown
and clodhopper in him are revealed to his inspection.
The coarse male boor.
With horny hands.
And hobnailed shoes.
And beefsteak jaw. Not rushing in, for that could be carried off. But
blundering.
Sauntering.
Stumping in.
Where great lovers, knights, and poets would have feared to tread.
How could I dare?
And dare, too, with such careless stupidity. Standing alone in the mist, he grows hot to the forehead at the thought of it.
I shall release her. She'll be glad to be rid of me.
What he has called her coldness seems now to be her patience. For he loves her now.
But it's all spoiled. Too late to mend matters.
The sky is growing brighter every minute.
Sir, can we be with you to the very end?
Child, you should not stay till then. You are waited for.
Me, sir?
Yes. Your husband is waiting for you in the lodge. Should you not go to him?
Must I go now?
If you leave the decision with me, it is now that I would send you.
Then I will go, sir.
Go in obedience, and you will find love. You will have no more dreams. Have children instead.
And Jane leaves the house with the director's kiss upon her lips and his words in her ears. She moves in the liquid light of the garden and its supernatural warmth, past the greenhouse and the piggery, across the wetness of the lawn, going down all the time, down to the lodge, descending the ladder of humility. First she thinks of the director, then she thinks of Melville, then she thinks of her obedience. And the setting of each foot before the other becomes a kind of sacrificial ceremony. She thinks of
children
and of
pain
and
death.
She thinks of Mark and all his sufferings, and the vision of Venus, raw and dangerous, comes to her mind.
How if he does not want me? How if he is not there?
A great gap of relief or disappointment, she cannot say, is made in her mind by this thought. But then she sees the window. The bedroom window of the lodge is open, and clothes piled on a chair inside so carelessly that the sleeve of a shirt, Mark's shirt, hangs down over the outside wall.
And in all this damp, too. How like Mark. How exactly like Mark.
In the final episode of That It Is Strength by C.S. Lewis, Jane was played by Catherine Halbert, Mark by Andrew Wincott, Featherston and Fisher King by Steve Hodson, McPhee and Wither by Jeffrey Banks, C.S. Lewis by Gerard Green, and Merlin by Robert Edison. Arthur was Andy Hockley, Camilla, Sean Lloyd-Owen, Miss Ironwood, Daphne Rogers, Dr. Dimble, Graham Goldcuff, and Mrs. Dimble, Tina Gray. Miss Hardcastle was Judy Bridgeland, Philostrato, Roger Hume, Strake, Robin Kyle, Jules, Graham Patton, Augustus Frost, Terry Malloy, and the tramp, Stephen Granville. The music was composed and played by Vic Gammon. That Hideous Strength was dramatised by Stephen Malatrat and directed at BBC Pebble Mill by Nigel Bryant.